What's going on? Welcome to The Scene with Doreen. I'm your host, Doreen Taylor, setting the scene each and every week to help you guys find out what's happening in TV, movies, music, sports, the arts, and everything in between. We are so proud to be syndicated on stations coast to coast and originating right here in the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia's number one talk radio station, Talk 860 WWDB. And you can always get insider access and go behind the scene on our show's official website, thescenewithdoreen.com. And it's a Memorial Day post-Memorial Day week, and my producer, Matt Menark, is off this week. So I am looking at my wonderful, my substitute, wonderful producer, the incredible Sam Whelan. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Doreen. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I've never ran your show before.
No, this is the first time. This is cool. Inaugural, like, kickoff.
Yeah, so if anything sounds bad, it's my fault.
No, it's always my fault. Don't ever, no, people out there in Radio Land. No, it's my fault, trust me. But it's Memorial Day. Did you do anything fun?
So we talked about this a little bit off air. I didn't even know it was a holiday weekend. So I was working here on Friday, and everyone's leaving early and saying, you know, have a good holiday. I didn't know what was going on, but hey, we got off Monday, so that was nice.
That's nice. Oh, okay. They gave you off Monday. Good.
Yeah.
Oh, see, so they don't overwork you. That's nice to know.
That's true. Yeah, we do get, you know, there are some perks. You know, we don't get most holidays, but sometimes if there's nothing going on or, you know, other shows don't come in, we get a little bit of a break.
That's very, very cool. Now, once you found out it was the holiday, though, did you celebrate at all? Did you have, like, a burger? Did you have a beer? I mean, did you do anything to kind of just kick off the summer season at all?
I did have a couple beers.
Good.
But hey, that was just because it was Monday.
That was just, you know what, that's sort of what I do every night anyway. So not beer, probably a little harder than that, but we're good because it's always good here at The Scene with Doreen. But we have a really cool show today. We have kind of a mishmash of people, but I just, like, we have 80s pop sensation Howard Jones, whose hits are still sticking in my head. They won't go away from the prep of the show. And then we have Dark Shadows maven. We have the incredible Catherine Lee Scott coming on later. And I didn't realize she was quite the Playboy Bunny in the original Playboy Bunny House and did a documentary and a lot of the behind the scenes with interviews. So it's going to be a fun show.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a good time. You know, it's two very eclectic guests,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
eager to hear what they have to say.
Yeah. All right. So, you know what? Without further ado, I'd say we go right into it. My first guest today on The Scene with Doreen is an electronic music pioneer who became one of the most influential and best-selling artists of mid-80s synth pop. Musician, singer, and songwriter Howard Jones dominated the charts with hits like No One Is to Blame, Like to Get to Know You Well, New Song, Everlasting Love, and of course his smash, Things Can Only Get Better. Take a listen. Oh, yes, Howard Jones defying the very essence of the 80s new wave pop synth scene. And even today, You can't go into a store or turn on the radio without hearing one of his infectious hooks and captivating vocals. He not only created music, but he created an entire new wave of sounds and musical ideas. Just having celebrated his 40th anniversary of his debut single, New Song, Howard is getting back on the road for a North American tour late this summer with ABC and Haircut 100, which is sure to delight any 80s alternative music fan. But before that, I'm lucky enough to have him join me on the scene with Doreen today, so it's with great honor that I welcome one of my own personal favorite songwriters and musicians, Howard Jones, to the show today. Hello, Howard. What's going on?
Hi, Doreen. Good. Thank you. We've got some nice weather here in the UK at the moment because we've had rain.
We have a lot of rain over here in Philadelphia, near Philadelphia. So we're getting rain. We're getting what you should be having.
Exactly.
Well, congratulations on just celebrating the 40th anniversary of your debut single, New Song. It was just last year. And that song really kickstarted your entire journey. How did you celebrate the milestone?
For me, it's like going out and doing a tour. That's how I celebrate. I love what I do. I feel very fortunate about that. I got great enthusiasm for performing live and creating new music and doing what I do, and it doesn't seem to be diminishing as I grow older. So there was no special party or anything. It was just like, where did that, you know, like I thought it was longer than 40 years actually.
It feels longer, right?
Yeah, because there's so much has gone on, so many things that I've been fortunate enough to do, and it's great to have survived.
Yes, survive. That's an interesting word. Yeah, because I heard a very interesting story about one of your earlier journeys. You were in a car accident with a drunk driver, and you and your wife were in that. And that sort of was the pinnacle for you to decide to pursue music full time and live your dream.
Absolutely. Yeah. I at the time, I was taking any job that I possibly could to sort of keep the music going. Mm-hmm. And one of the crazy things we did was to sell vegetables and fruit from the back of a van around our local area. And one night, you know, a drunken driver smashed into the front of the van whilst it was parked, and we were serving one of the customers. And my wife got trapped underneath the van, and it was like scary. It was the most scariest thing. And I knew that I might have lost her that night. And I was in the van, you know, sorting things out. I could have lost my life as well. Both could have gone that night. So I was thinking, you know, there's no time to waste. You really must get on with the music. Just don't worry about it. Just throw everything at it. And Jan damaged her back in that accident, and she wanted the money, the compensation money, which was modest, to give that to me so I could buy more equipment, and synthesizers and drum machines. Mm. And that really helped things to take off. And within like 6 months, I'd been signed by Warner Brothers. So it was a pivotal moment, yeah.
Yes, it was. And is it true when you had your first synthesizer that you got it, you got two, that they sent you two?
Yeah, that's right. By accident, I don't know what happened. I mean, I picked one up at the store, and then they sent me one. So I had one for playing bass and one for playing the top line. It was a big part of my sound, and I did pay for it, by the way. I didn't just accept it. I thought, I want to start off on the right foot here.
good karma.
So I think it was 250 quid, because that's what it cost. And so, but it gave me this idea to have the one man show where I could play the bass, do the top line, and have sequences and drum machines running. And it was really kind of a fantastic piece of fate, that was, actually.
I was going to say, a lot of your journey is fate. I mean, just the two stories you've just told alone, if they had not happened, I talk about this with a lot of my guests, that if something in your career, that one little moment or something, it's sort of that snowball that just brings everything together. And if that didn't happen, do you ever think like where you'd be now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about, you know, recognizing the moment that you're in, and that actually this is really significant. Don't just take it lightly. Like, you know, if some, you know, if, when you meet somebody that really impresses you, like I had this guy, I was doing a gig in a little pub in High Wycombe where I lived, and this guy burst through the dressing room door and said, I want to be involved with this. I want to be involved with this, literally. And I'd never met him before. And I said, all right, then.
Involved.
And he became my tour manager. We toured the whole world together.
Wow.
And he's still one of my best friends. So, you know, I think it's like recognizing those moments and like taking them, grabbing them, you know.
Never saying no to an opportunity. Always exploring it. Yes, especially that. I don't recommend to people, though, to burst through things backstage. All my listeners, please don't. Don't go back. Yes. Don't do that. But it worked in Howard's case, but please don't do that. But
no, that's true. I mean, it was then that particular place, it was possible to do that. You wouldn't be able to do that now.
No. Well, it depends on the club. Some clubs, I've seen it happen where someone gets back there and you're like, how did you just get through 10 layers of security? But somehow that's a talent. They can do it. Thank God they're never usually the really unhinged ones, though. They're just the really nice fans that love you, but they're not the ones that are there for harm anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yes. That's you know, your lyrics, you were very different for the time, especially your sound. You really did revolutionize a new sound, a new wave, so to speak. I know that new song, because we touched on it with the 40th anniversary, it was very personal to you in your approach to the times, the lyrics that you wrote. And honestly, looking at it, they're very relevant for the time, but even more so now today.
Well, I mean, always lyrics have been the most important thing for me. Obviously, I love music, but, you know, it's like what message is the music going to carry? Because it's like unfair in a way, because music gets passed, you know, right into your brain. And you know, you can't resist it in a way. So I was thinking, like, got to make sure that if you've got that pathway into people's minds, then make sure that the message is going to be of use to them. So for me, new song was about what happened to me. You know, I've been waiting for a long time. I was 28 before I got signed. I was really, this is what I wanted to do with my life. And the song says, you know, don't crack up and bend your brain and see both sides and throw off your mental chains and be, you know, live life with a sense of freedom, not being, you know, sort of scared of everything, you know, like, don't be frightened to have a go, you know, and if it goes wrong, well, pick yourself up next day and carry on. I wanted to, that was my story getting to where I'd go. I wanted to put that in the songs.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful message. And I think the music was a good delivery system. I got to tell you, I was just talking with my crew here before you came on. You, my friend, are incredible with creating a hook. I have been humming your songs. I mean, I've heard your songs for many, many years, but since I've been preparing for this interview, you're the one that sticks in my brain during the night, during when I'm having my coffee. I mean, you write an incredible earworm. I mean, really, you do.
Well, I guess, you know, that's my thing. I'm the same with other people's music and classical pieces and things like that. I now recognize that when I'm writing, it's got to be that when I wake up the next morning, that's all that's in my head.
Yes.
Is that hook.
Yes.
And that line.
Yes.
And then, and if it's not, then I don't proceed with it. So it's sort of recognizing that thing that will really stick with me and stick with other people and become part of them.
I really think the 80s, honestly, it was the last decade, in my personal opinion, where a good hook was in a song. I think the 90s sort of kind of got out of that a little, and then we got worse as we went on. But the 80s was all about an amazing hook, and I you'd had that.
Well, I suppose that I was very... Yeah, I mean, it's just my thing, you know, to do that. I loved creating tunes and sounds and things that really stuck with you and, you know, really works in pop music.
Yes, but you mentioned you like classical, and that kind of opened my mind because a lot of the artists I have on, like I had Steve Vai on, and he's incredibly talented in classical. Kip Winger from Winger, frontman of Winger. He is an incredible classical and Broadway composer now. Did you ever want to dive into that world of classical?
Well, I have that outlet because I mean, that's one of the things I'm working on at the moment. I've got a whole set of classical piano pieces that I composed during the lockdown, and that's going to be released later this year. So that's very important to me because I studied classical music from the age of 7 till I was 21. So that's a big part of my musical life as well, and you know, I think. Yeah, I've drawn, you know, I love jazz. I mean, I love all music that's done well, and I just want to listen to it, you know, and I don't think we should ever, I went to the opera just recently as well, you know, I mean, like, open yourself up to all kinds of influences is really good, and it helps you understand broader things, you know, different cultures and different ways of being, different ways of talking, different ways of singing. You know, I think it's a great education to open yourself up to all different genres.
Yes, an eclectic musician is the best musician, in my opinion.
Yeah, I really agree.
Yes, you know, I did say in the introduction that I am personally a huge fan of your music, and just today I was driving to the radio studio, and Everlasting Love came on the radio. Do you ever hear your music when you're just out and about? And if it does, what do you do? And how does it make you feel after all these years?
Okay. I've got a great, I mean, Jan and I were in Santa Monica for about 6 weeks last summer. And so, you know, it's a big thing for us. It's fun to be in America. And so we're in Whole Foods, I think it was. And I've got my trolley and I'm pushing it around, you know, getting all these organic veg and fruit. Mm-hmm. And suddenly one of my songs comes on and there's people around me start singing it, you know, like pushing their trolley, singing it. And I'm thinking, how do I, what's my
Yeah, what do you do? What do you do?
So I go, that's me.
Good for you. Good.
Oh, no, but I don't. I
no, you didn't. Oh, you didn't. Oh, no, I would have.
I mean, I'm not, I didn't do that. I was thinking, but should I? And then people would go, oh, come on, no, you know, they'd think you was just crazy. And
in Santa Monica, maybe it could happen.
Yeah, but it was a buzz though. Seeing people singing along with it and like doing their shopping, it was like really great. Yeah,
you know, there are many people who credit you for ushering in an entirely new wave of sound and musical ideas. When you were writing and producing your music 40 plus years ago, did you ever think that one day you would be revered as a pioneer in electronic music?
No, I didn't. It's never been the important thing for me. That what I wanted to be thought well of was what the lyrics said, you know, and how they. I really wasn't bothered about the pioneering stuff. It's true. I mean, I was one of, I think maybe the first person to do a one man electronic show and do things in that way. But it's the lyrics of things can only get better. It's the lyrics of like to get to know you well, of, you know, new song, what is love, that I would really like to be remembered for. Because that's, you know, my sort of contribution, you know, that's on my side. Mm-hmm.
You know, I do have to mention, because I learned something. I always try to learn something new when I bring on an, you know, even though I know a lot about you, I learned something new. Your biggest hit, at least in the U.S., was No One Is to Blame. But a lot of my listeners may not realize that the first version was on your Dream Into Action album, but you re-recorded it. And got Phil Collins on board as drummer, backing vocals, and he co-produced. I had no idea he was part of that song with you.
Yeah. Well, I'd got to know Phil because we'd done the Prince's Trust concerts, you know, the charity things in London. He's on drums. I was on the keyboards, and we were playing with all the amazing artists in the world at the time. And so I got to know Phil. I really liked him. He's a really warm character, you know, gives you a big hug and makes you feel completely at home. So I didn't feel, you know, bad about phoning him up and saying, Phil, would you like to have a go at this song? Because I think it could really work at radio. And I think you're the man to help me do that. And he loved the song. And we recorded it in 2 days. No, 2 weekends it was down at Genesis Studios. And it made itself so quickly and turned out to be like a little gem. So, yeah, very, very fond memories of Phil and making that.
You're very great. Modest, a little gem. That was a song that was radio gold, peaked at number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100 and number 1 on the U.S. Adult Contemporary chart. And, you know, we Americans, we're tough. We're tough with our music. So I know that was big for you to break over here. Madison Square Garden was your dream as a boy. You wanted to, that was your big dream to play there, and you did.
Yes, that's right. It was always, you know, reading the music press in the UK when I was growing up in the 70s. You know, all my favorite bands, they ended up playing Madison Square Garden. I thought, well, you know, I want to do that. I want to be there. I want to play that amazing venue. And I, you know, managed to do it in the end. It was great. It was fantastic.
Yes, you did. Experience. Yes. And I do want to talk about one thing, because I found it fascinating that most of the musical artists I have come on, they are very scared even of AI in music, especially.
Right.
While on the other hand, you are not, my friend. You are excited about AI. And I even heard a rumor that you want to create music with AI, with your vocals, and do chorus effects and a whole new kind of, you're making new waves of sound, I believe.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like anything. I when I first emerged on the scene, right, and I was using drum machines, I was using synthesizers, and they wanted to ban me from the Musicians Union, and because they thought that I was taking work away from people, and you know, it was wrong to do what I did. But you know, I kind of had a vision that actually using this technology would open up so many avenues for people, especially people at home, like working, you know, with musical as music as their hobby or their passion, but never taking it professionally. They could build tracks at home and have fun with music, and that is what happened. And of course, then with sampling, people thought, oh, that's going to be the end of because people can just take your sound and steal it and use it on their records. But people used it in the most creative way, as well as people who nicked it, you know. And I think that just applies to any new technology. We do have to be careful that it doesn't, steal from people and stop people making a living from their music. Because if we do that, then we won't have any music, you know. Sure. Artists are really important. But there's always going to be, there's a side of it that is so... that can be used very creatively, and people will do that, and they'll come up with amazing things. So we just have to have a balanced view, I think, of anything new. There's going to be a good side, there's going to be a bad side.
Yes.
And let's minimize the bad side, take advantage of the great stuff.
Right, right. With the formation of technology and wherever it goes, we have to be responsible. Like they say in Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yes.
And we just need to, you know, harness the good.
Yes, sir. Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's what, and that, you know, it applies to everything. It's like, you know, nuclear power, you know.
True.
Makes bombs, also creates energy for, you know, it's like pretty much, you know, everything you think about can be used in a negative way. We've just got to avoid that.
Yes. You know? Hopefully, I think maybe. There will always be that one person, though. There will always be.
Yeah. Yes.
But you are not. No, you do good.
Well, you know, I try to. There's some things you know, that you can't even be aware of. But
yes, yes.
But yeah, you know, having that on one's mind, I think, you know, helps to keep away from that. Yeah.
I am talking with synth pop, new wave, and electric music pioneer Howard Jones. When we come back, we will talk about Howard's new tour, what's next for the alternative pop icon, and we'll wrap it all up. Just stick right there. We'll be right back.
Tired of shopping for furniture and not finding what you want? Concerned about quality, value, or reputation of most online stores? GrossmanFurniture.com is your answer. We've been furnishing homes for 95 years, and we continue to offer our customers the best price every day, guaranteed. We specialize in customizing over 200 leading brands of furniture to fit your style, your home, and your budget. See why we've been the go-to furniture choice in historic Philadelphia for almost a century. Shipping nationwide, coast to coast, our virtual grossmanfurniture.com showroom makes it easy and comfortable for you to shop online for quality furniture and decor. Check out our exclusive Made in America furniture lines. Visit us online today and allow us to help you make your dream house your dream home. Log on at grossmanfurniture.com. That's grossmanfurniture.com.
We're not scared to lose it all. Security thrown through the wall. Future dreams we have to realize. A thousand skepticals won't keep us from the things we've planned. Unless we're clinging to the things we've prized. And do you feel scared? I do. But I won't stop and falter.
Welcome back to The Scene with Doreen. I'm your host, Doreen Taylor, and I am chatting with new wave 80s pop synth superstar and visionary Howard Jones. Howard, wow, that was an acoustic live performance you did back in August 2020, and I believe that's during the height of COVID. And listening to that song and your lyrics, I couldn't have picked a better positive message for that time, even though it was written decades prior.
Yeah. It was. I was scratching my head, you know, because we were all, you know, locked away, and I wanted to do something for the fans, you know, to sort of, you know, help a bit. So it was great, and I got some great feedback from people who are watching this live stream, you know, in Wales, looking out over the mountains, and and because you could pick that signal up anywhere that had internet, so it was great actually to do that, and it was the hardest gig ever because it was live and there was no audience at all, so there's no feedback, you know, even the cameramen are moving around filming it, but there's no reaction, so and it's just me and the piano. So I had to get the singing had to be like really on it, the playing had to be, you know, because there was no going back and editing it. So
yes, true.
It was challenging. So, but that's good, isn't it? You know, challenging yourself makes you better.
Well, it's so real and organic and just heartfelt and very intimate. That's how I took away from that. And during that time, it felt like a perfect kind of layer of what, you know, just to make people feel not alone at that time too.
Yeah, I was very worried because when I was talking between the songs, I was thinking, oh, there's you know, people all over the world listening to this and just imagining them, you know, at home. I could see them or anything like that, but like being really aware that there's people, you know, absolutely focusing on this and watching. It was a great experience, actually. I really, really, that was one of my best experiences during the COVID era, really.
Yes. Yeah. And you do a beautiful job acoustically. And I love that people get to hear you really play piano too, you know, like a strict, just, you know, acoustic piano. And that it's nice to hear that different side.
Yeah, it is. I feel very comfortable doing that. You know, it's where that's what I do when I'm at home. I'm playing the piano, I'm singing, and it's the most natural way to perform. I mean, with a band, you know, the sort of big personality and like, you know, thousands of people and everything, it's it still requires a bit of effort from me to be that person.
Get used to it, because that leads me to my next point. You're getting back on the road in August and September of this year for a North American tour with ABC and Haircut 100. Great lineup, especially knowing that Haircut 100 will be playing North America for the first time in 40 years with the original band.
Incredible, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, I'm very excited. It's such a classy lineup, you know?
Yeah.
And I think people are going to get a whole evening of, like, amazing songs and playing and sounds. And so, I you know, we kind of waited quite a long time to put this you know, team together. And honestly, it's getting such a ridiculous reaction. We're having to add shows all over the place because they're selling out so fast.
Wow, that's a nice problem to have. That's a nice problem to have.
It really is a nice problem.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to cry tears for you. Sorry, it's not happening. No. You're getting back on the road. You use a lot of falsetto in your vocals. What do you do on tour to preserve your vocals and keep it going night after night, especially since falsetto takes a lot of vocal control?
Yes, you're absolutely right. So, I've got an amazing singing teacher here in the UK, who's a great friend of mine called James Windsor, and he's given me a whole set of exercises that I've recorded and that I do before every show to get the voice in good shape.
What's your favorite? Lip trill? What do you do? What is your go-to? I always ask this of my singers.
Actually, it's making animal noises.
That's me too, elephant. I do the elephant for the vibration in the front of the mouth. And what else do you do? What other animals? I'm curious now.
I do dogs. I do barking.
Oh.
I do owls.
Oh.
All that. I do, what else? Gorillas.
Oh, that's good for breathing. Deep breathing. Yes, it's very good. Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, so lots, and it sort of opens up the top end of the voice, and because you do all this stuff yourself. So it really helps me. That's my way of doing it.
Yeah, sirens. I know siren is a very good one to do. Like, you have a different siren noise though in the UK. I don't think we have a whiny, very high pitched siren in the US, but yours is a little different. I don't know if that would work as a vocal technique thing or vocal warm up. I don't think that would work. Yeah. Hey, there you go. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, really sort of stretching the vocal cords like to be stretched. They don't like actually talking much. It's not good for the voice, but like when you're going, you know, you're moving it around, giving it lots of sort of exercise, it's happy.
Yes, true. How do you keep yourself mentally engaged while playing your tunes that you've played for almost four decades? How do you keep it fresh?
Well, adrenaline and fear is part of it. You know,
those are always good things.
Go out on stage. I know I've done it thousands of times, but it's still like those people have come from all over the place, paid loads of money, traveled for hours, got babysitters, you know, the whole thing to be there that night. You better be good for them. You know, you've got to be good for them. So, and that's keeps my focus very sharp.
You still get the butterflies, huh? You still get the butterflies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I hope I always do, because there should be an element of like, oh, I hope I'm going to be all right. I hope I'm going to be good tonight. I want to be great. I want to be great for them.
Yeah.
You know, that's my job. That's my job, is to be great.
Yeah. I bet your philosophy is you're the same for if you're playing for one person in a room. Like you said, even with the COVID, you didn't know who you were playing for. Versus a packed arena at Madison Square Garden. So, I mean, I always think everybody deserves that same show regardless.
Yeah, I completely agree. I completely agree with that. And I've been there. You know, at one time in my career, I was in Switzerland doing a show and six people turned up.
We've all been there. We have all been there.
I climbed into the audience and introduced myself individually to every single one of them, and then gave the show just like I would any other time.
Yeah.
And think, well, I'm still doing what I love doing, but what happens? But fortunately, it didn't stay like that for too long. But, you know, I have experienced that, and it's really good. It's really good.
It's a humbling emotion to go through that, especially in the beginning, you know, to feel that and to keep going, knowing that that is a possibility. It's humbling. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And it keeps your feet on the ground. You know, that's a good thing.
Yes. So what advice would you give the next class of aspiring musicians who want to blaze a musical path for others just like you did?
Yeah. Well, I would say that to think of it like this, that you've got this talent and you should be sharing it with everyone. Don't think about like making a fortune or being famous or anything like that, but like, this is your talent and this is what the world needs. It needs to hear you express that as your individual self. And so just absolutely put everything in it. And it, you know, for me, the definition of success isn't playing for, you know, tens of thousands of people every night. It can be just as moving and effective to play, like we said before, in your front room to your friends and express, you know, human emotion and feeling to them. That can be as powerful as a big show. So never be put off by size or, you know, oh, you know, how much money's been generated or how many streams you've got or anything. That's not the important thing. It's like, are you giving everything you've got to your art and connecting with people? That's what I would say. You know, because we need you. We need artists. We need people to express those human emotions that we all feel. We need to be able to connect in that way. So please don't worry about size. Don't worry about what's traditionally called success. Just go for it.
And be like you. Take a chance. Do something that you conceived in your head and make it real. Yeah. And who cares if people like it or don't? You do it because it's what you want to do.
Yeah, yeah. I actually always remember hearing an interview with Sting, and he said, and people said to you, "Well, you know, what would you be doing if you weren't doing this?" So he said, "Well, I'd just be playing down the pub. I'd still be doing music. That's what I do. I'd be playing to 20 people in a pub if I wasn't doing that." And the same with me. I'd be doing music in some way. I was fortunate enough to get, this position I'm in. So, and I'll take credit for that. But if I didn't have those breaks in my life, I would, I'd be there in the pub doing songs for people.
Yes.
Like where I started.
Yes. When it's part of you, you have to do it.
Yeah.
You just have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, and it is part of you, and I am so thankful that you shared that part of you with the rest of the world so that even 40 years later, we still have this gift that is going to keep going for another 40 times 40 times 40. And I would ask where you will be, but you'll still be performing.
I drop, until I drop, I'll keep going,
Looking back now, they always say hindsight is 20/20. What is the one takeaway? If you could take one thing from this incredible career of yours, and it's still not done, it's still got plenty to go, what would be the one takeaway that you think you've learned, maybe not even musical, but what is the biggest takeaway that you can have from your 40-year-plus career?
I think, you know, it's really important not to compare yourself with other people. Mm-hmm. Just be comparing yourself with yourself, what you did yesterday. Mm. And if we get caught up with going, oh, but this person did this and this person is playing, you know, multiple arenas and doing like billions of streams. Please, you know, we mustn't do that. We must like just be the best thing that we can do.
Yes.
And that is always going to be good enough. That's good enough. And it's like, what other people do is great. Who knows what their life is like, off stage, off camera. I mean, we just will never know that. So to be happy in where you are, what you're doing, and moving forward, that would be the takeaway. And sometimes I've been very guilty of that, you know, comparing myself to others and becoming miserable through it. So I'm not going to do that anymore. I'll just be me and do my best. You know, then that's good enough for anyone.
Yes.
Yeah.
On that note, I don't think we can say anything better, because that's just the perfect way to end this. And Mr. Howard Jones, thank you for providing 40 years of incredible music, plus 40 years plus. And I want to see you when you come out on tour, because I know you're stopping in New Jersey. You're going to be in Las Vegas. You're going to be in Niagara Falls. Well, I'm a Buffalo, New York girl, born and raised. Oh. So I know that you're going to the Falls View Casino up there. So a lot of my friends are up there. And you're just everywhere. You're Cleveland. You're Montclair, New Jersey, Port Chester, New York, Huntington, New York. So check your website, howardjones.com, all your fans. You're going to be touring North American tour starting August 14th. I know you're adding dates, too. So go check those, everyone, and see what dates are being added. And go see Howard Jones, go see ABC, and go see Haircut 100 on tour. Yes, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. You are a pleasure.
I thoroughly enjoyed it speaking with you, Doreen. Thank you so much. It's been really, really great.
Likewise. You're very inspiring. You do. I came in a little gloomy today, and you made me leave feeling very optimistic and really very happy. So thank you.
Fantastic. All right.
You'll enjoy really and good luck on your tour.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
All the best.
You too. Bye-bye. Welcome back. My next guest today on The Scene with Doreen is best known for her work on the ABC gothic soap opera Dark Shadows, but her incredible body of work only begins there. For over 50 years, actress and author Katherine Lee Scott has been gracing the big and small screens alike, appearing alongside Robert Redford in the 1974 movie The Great Gatsby, or opposite George C. Scott in The Last Days of Patton. You have also seen her in Star Trek The Next Generation as Nuria, and recently as George Siegel's girlfriend in the hit show The Goldbergs. Most recently, however, she is still honorably carrying the Dark Shadows torch and will be appearing at the Dark Shadows Remembrance Weekend on July 5th in Burbank, California, where they will celebrate the life of Laura Parker and the 100th birthday of the late Jonathan Freed, who famously played the game-changing role of Barnabas Collins. We have a lot to discuss, so let's just get this show on the road. I am thrilled to be able to welcome the beautiful and talented Katherine Lee Scott to the show. Welcome to The Scene with Doreen. Katherine, what's going on?
Thank you, Doreen. What a pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. You truly are iconic. And I mean, you are tied to one of the most iconic television shows, probably the best performing daytime TV shows of all time.
Well, at our height, we had 20 million viewers. Imagine how many primetime shows or streamers would love to have 20 million viewers.
Including this one right here. No, that is wonderful.
That was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. In some places, it played at 4 o'clock, but we were known as the show the kids ran home from school to watch. Yes. And I still have people come up to me in the post office. They recognize my voice, or maybe me, or the supermarket, and tell me that some of the best memories they have were sitting on the couch and watching Dark Shadows after school.
Oh, well, the incredible success that the original Dark Shadows series, it ran from 66 to 71, had a total of 1,255 episodes in just 6 years. And it would spawn a media franchise, several films, Tim Burton reboot, and even a series of spin-off novels and comic books. But what I found fascinating, it didn't even almost happen. The ratings were low. Creator Dan Curtis has this wacky idea 10 months into the run to introduce a vampire to the gothic daytime soap. Nothing was done like that ever before, was it?
No, we really, we were really innovative, and there were several things. Most of the daytime shows were just contemporary, you know, sitting around the coffee table talking about mundane things. And we time traveled. We started in the 1960s, and we time traveled back to 1897, 1790. The actors on the show functioned like a repertory company. We played multiple roles in these costume dramas, and we also borrowed from great literature, everything from from Frankenstein to Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre and Picture of Dorian Gray, Turn of the Screw, and the fact that all of us were stage trained, even the young ones on the show, and I guess I would be considered one of the young ones. I started in the show straight out of drama school. So it was innovative. And there are so many there are so many directors that I've met over the years who've said that, you know, they were fans of the show, mm-hmm. and the special effects that we did long before CGI were kind of inspired them in their careers.
Right. You were Twilight before Twilight. I mean, to bring it to like a more modern reference, I mean, that you were the originator of that. And it's amazing to think that it was greenlit back then, you know, in the times and everything in the 60s. And someone said, yeah, let's buy into this. And I'm shocked they did it, honestly.
Yeah, there was at ABC, it was Brandon Stoddard who let Dan Curtis, who was our creator, go ahead with this crazy idea, which started out as a dream that Dan Curtis had about a girl who had grown up in a foundling home and orphanage, and she'd been hired as a governess for this Cullen's family and the eccentric family in a little town in Maine, Cullensport, and she arrives by train. That was the opening sequence, and it was so Jane Eyre, and it started off as what we call a bodice ripper, you know, just a gothic romance. And when Jonathan Frid came on as the vampire, everything changed. That's, as you said, that's when the show took off and our ratings just went sky high.
Yes. And again, what an idea to kind of come up with this out of the blue. Was that another dream, I wonder? What was he taking before like going to sleep? I'd like to take some of that.
From what I hear, and I've stayed in touch with him, he had three daughters, and they wanted something spooky. And so Dan gave it to them in the form of a vampire. So on July 5th and 6th, this year, we're getting together to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the 200-year-old vampire. Jonathan Frid would have been 100 years old this year. Wow. So we're gathering in Burbank, California, at the Burbank Marriott Hotel, and we're going to have a 2-day celebration. We're also celebrating the life of Laura Parker, my very dear friend who played Angelique on
Angelique,
the show.
Yes.
Yep, she passed away last October, and I miss her terribly. And we're going to have a memorial for her the night before, which is free and open to the public. And then the following day, we've got a full day. Nancy Barrett will be there. David Selby, who played Quentin. Jim Storm. Several of the actors. Lisa Richards will be there. And, of course, I'll be there. And we'll be meeting and greeting the fans and having a lunch celebration with a lot of surprises. And anybody attending on that day for the lunch will be leaving with an overflowing bag of Dark Shadows memorabilia.
Ooh, swag. So, very nice.
That's going to be a lunch celebrating Jonathan Frid. And we're all going to be performing. We all have a little something that we're going to do as a kind of a special treat for the fans that are there.
Oh, how wonderful. Now, can you give us any look into one of the surprises? Anything you can give us as an exclusive?
Well, all right. I'm just going to hint at this. Okay. This is a total surprise that even the organizers of this event don't know what I've got in mind.
Okay.
But, I'm going to be bringing special video greetings from a beloved actor on the show that won't be able to be there that day, but that'll be very special. You know, we haven't had a Dark Shadows Festival or a gathering for a couple of years, so this will be special. And if anybody wants to join us on July 6th, just go to Eventbrite and look up Dark Shadows Remembrance, and you can register then. I'm expecting quite a big turnout. You know, we used to have thousands of people showing up at our Dark Shadows festivals, and we had them all over the country. It was really great fun.
Well, it's a cult following. I know that there is a show, I don't even know if you know this, but King of Queens They had one of the characters who's Patton Oswalt, who was Spence Olchin on the show. He was going to a Dark Shadows convention, and that was like a big sticking point with him and his girlfriend. And it's just funny because he dressed up like Barnabas, and you know, and it was just, I don't even know if you know that. I should send you that link. That it's very funny.
Wonderful. I would love to see that. As a matter of fact, you know, I also did Star Trek. I played Nuria. Yes. Watchers, and I'm going to join Armin Shimerman and my old pal Kitty Swink. They're going to be at Trek Long Island, it's called.
And I'm going close to us. We're in Philadelphia, so that's very close to a lot of people here.
It's in Haupaug. I think I've pronounced that correctly. It's on Long Island, Haupauge.
That sounds right.
It's called Trek Long Island, and I'm going up there for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I'm really looking forward to it. Oh. So that's my life. It's 50 some years since I did Dark Shadows. It's I did Star Trek Next Generation in the mid 80s. So it's really kind of fun to see the fans of these shows. And Star Trek started, the original Star Trek started the same year as Dark Shadows.
Oh, that's true. We just had William Shatner on the show. And you're right. The timing is coincidental. I think not. No.
You're right. Well, Gene Roddenberry, who is a genius, did Star Trek Going into the Future. And Dan Curtis, an equally creative person, took Dark Shadows back in time. Yeah. And it's so interesting that they both started in 1966.
Yes. And theirs lasted for what, 3 years? And yours lasted a lot longer, a lot more episodes.
Hell, we did 4 years. And I think Star Trek did 80, if I'm remembering correctly, I think it's 87 episodes.
Something like that. Yep. So you win.
This is kind of fun to do.
Oh, yes. And, you know, you've continued on with the Dark Shadows legacy and narrated all 27 vintage Dark Shadows novels by Marilyn Ross for Oasis Audiobooks and available on Amazon.com. I wanted to give you a shout out for being the voice of Dark Shadows going on.
Thank you. I also, I've written a few books about Dark Shadows. The one that I think is probably a companion to all of the episodes is Dark Shadows Return to Cullenwood. It's a complete episode guide. It's behind the scenes anecdotes about Dark Shadows, and it's full of photographs. And, you know, Dark Shadows has come back several times, including the most recent, the 2012 iteration that Johnny Depp and Tim Burton did as a feature film. But now there's a very good chance that Dark Shadows is coming back as probably in a streamer, but as a primetime series.
Oh.
We will probably know by the time we get together in July, we'll probably know if it's a go, which would really be fun.
Oh, yes. I get goosebumps. Just think, see another exclusive maybe, my listeners. I don't know. But, I'm very glad you brought up the fact of what an incredible writer you are, because I want to take a little bit of a break. But I'm chatting with actress, author, and publisher Catherine Lee Scott. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the Dark Shadows actress and dive into the writing side of her life. Stay tuned. Hey guys, are you loving the show? Do you want to see more of The Scene? Well, guess what? You can, because The Scene with Doreen is now a weekly segment on the nationally syndicated television show, The Daily Flash. The Daily Flash is your daily destination for trending stories, celebrity updates, and industry highlights. And it's now your home to watch The Scene with Doreen. You can turn us on and watch every Wednesday across the country. Check your local times and listings at thescenewithdoreen.com.
There was a side of Playboy that nobody wants to talk about.
He was an advocate for sexual freedom and the First Amendment.
And he really did believe he owned these women.
There's some things that I never saw the light of day.
I didn't realize that getting into the Playboy world was a dangerous choice.
He didn't want people to know what was really going on.
I have extensive electronic equipment in the house, which includes videotape equipment. Sometimes things happen in the bedroom. It was a beautiful world. It looked that way, but it was really ugly.
When you get someone that powerful, anything could happen. Anything.
I wouldn't trade places with anyone else in the world.
His legacy should comprise the whole story.
The people who are really there, they're the ones who know the real truth.
Yes, welcome back to The Scene with Doreen. I'm your host, Doreen Taylor, and I am chatting with my wonderful guest and the very talented actress, but also writer and publisher, Catherine Lee Scott. Catherine, you truly have created a dual career where your writing is just as celebrated as your acting, and you've written multiple novels. You've started your own publishing company called Pomegranate Press, which you released the groundbreaking book, The Bunny Years, the surprising inside story of Playboy clubs about your own time as a Playboy bunny. That project was huge, and it really was groundbreaking. It opened the door for the A&E special that we just heard the trailer for, The Secrets of Playboy.
Yes, I'm not a fan of The Secrets of Playboy. The one accurate thing that I heard there is the people who were there know the truth. And I was one of the first bunnies hired at the New York Club, and I was still a student. I was attending the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and working as a Playboy bunny in the New York Club was my bread and butter job. And for me, it was an absolutely wonderful experience. I learned how to conduct myself in an adult workplace and send up the right signals about how I wanted to be treated. And that stood me in good stead my entire life. I as an actress, as a publisher, as a writer, as everything that I have done. Mm-hmm. I wrote the book, The Bunny Years, because I was in bunny training with Gloria Steinem. Mm-hmm. And she wrote about me in her two-part article in Show Magazine. Okay. And I was so disappointed because I felt that she wrote about us in such a disparaging way. I think it's one thing to diss the place that you're working, but to diss the young women that you worked with, most of us a good decade younger than Gloria, who, you know, were launching careers and finishing school, and Playboy was the bread and butter job that gave us the funds to do that. Mm-hmm. At a time back in the 60s when, you know, it was not easy for a woman to get a credit card in her own name or get a mortgage or anything. Yeah. And working at the Playboy Club was just, it was glamorous, it was fun, and it was certainly lucrative. And I did a documentary some years ago based on my experiences at the club and also the 300 and some women that I interviewed for the Bunny Years. And I'm now reissuing the documentary.
Oh, good.
And some of the women that were hired with me are in it. Lauren Hutton, who is a model and an actress.
Oh, yes.
We were the same day. And Susan Sullivan, I think you know her from Dharma and Greg and Castle. So for many of us, it was a really wonderful experience. And you know, we were there. We're giving firsthand experience.
Right. Well, you know better than anyone in the Hollywood realm and in that world, sensational sells. And of course, they have to, for the A&E special, they had to sex it up and make it more drama and things like that. Whereas in you were just really, truly showing the highlights from these 250 plus women that you interviewed. So I understand, like, what did you dislike about the A&E special so much? You know, the main thing that you really just disliked about it.
Oh, you know, I, to be perfectly honest, the people that did that got in touch with me a couple of years before they started. And I think that they didn't realize my background, having written the book and so on. But I would not have wanted to be participating in that show. I think it's sensationalism. It's exploitative.
Yes.
And you know, so many of the people that I understand are in it, and I really didn't watch it. I saw little clips of it, so I know where it was going.
Yes.
I watched trailers of it.
I'm with you on that, actually. So there you are with me.
It was not my experience, nor the experience of most of the women,
right,
who worked as Playboy bunnies. And by the way, I think the A&E special, from the bits that I have seen, conflated Playboy bunnies with the women who lived at the mansion.
Yes.
That's a totally different experience.
Yes.
We were waitresses. We worked at the club serving food and drink, and we did that, until it was certainly not a career. But I think the bulk of the people that are in that A&E special, the Secrets of Playboy, really, they were playmates, they were girlfriends of Hefner, they lived at the mansion. That's a totally, totally different lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It has absolutely nothing to do with being a Playboy bunny.
Yes. Very true. Very true. And I think that was where there was a lot of blurring of lines in that whole series, from what I've gathered and the feedback I've gotten from other people. But I'm glad that you're here to speak about it, and your own true experience was a positive one for you. And, you know, I already know a lot based on your experience. But when you were interviewing the 250 plus former bunnies, was there anything that shocked you that came out, though? Was there a story that you just said, wow, that was not my experience, or that really surprised me that I didn't know that.
You know, the rules were so strict at Playboy. I mean, obviously management was well aware that, sending nubile young women, 18, 19, 20 years old, dressed, in these provocative, evocative costumes, serving food and drink in a nightclub atmosphere. And we were a handful. We were, young women who, and we were young women.
Oh, yes. I was going to say lots of personalities.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. they knew that they what they had on their hands.
Yes.
So they had very, very strict rules about conduct within the club. I never personally experienced a problem in the time that I was there. And in interviewing all of the women that did say, somebody touched them or tried to take their cottontail as a mm-hmm. souvenir or whatever, all you had to do was call the room director over, and that person lost their privilege of membership. They were no longer allowed in the club, and I simply did not interview a woman who had a real problem. It probably happened. There were 25 clubs all over the world.
Yes.
I don't know. I interviewed well over 250 women, and I did not come across a bad experience of the sort that I understand.
That's wonderful.
It goes on in The Secrets of Playboy.
I know you watch that show and you think everybody had this awful experience. And it's so nice and endearing to hear about yours. And like you said, you could pull out, I mean, we'll use McDonald's. There's all these McDonald's. If you actually put that many people together in different clubs and different restaurants, you're going to find a problem. And it's a McDonald's. There's always going to be something that happens with different people. So, of course, the odds are something will happen. But on your experience and the people that you interviewed, it's good to know. And I know that it did help a lot of women, like you said, learn and hone in skills that taught you how to be who you are today.
Well, I'm. It's because of that A&E special that I got the rights back to The Bunny Years, the documentary that I did some years ago, and I'm just updating it, and it'll be out later this year.
Wonderful.
And I think it's the it's the flip side of the coin, and I completely understand that doing something salacious is going to, draw eyeballs to the screen.
Mm-hmm.
People are fascinated by, that sort of thing. And of course, there are people that are going to want their, 5 seconds of fame, talking about such a thing.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But I'm very pleased that I'm able to present the other viewpoint as well.
Yes, I'm very happy you are to have a really good conversation about anything, you have to present both sides of the coin. And I'm glad that you're doing that.
Yeah. Doreen, thank you so much for even asking me about that.
Oh, I love it. I'm so glad, because I find that it is something very important to talk about in all of your writing. The fact that you have that really wonderful talent, besides the acting, which is incredible, you have that whole other side of the brain that you're creating, and your own publishing company, Pomegranate Press, that you put out other works by other artists too. Mostly nonfiction, I see, but you know that
it's mostly entertainment subjects. But yes. You know, I really love book publishing. Well, first of all, I'm a great reader and love books, but the fact that I've been able to publish so many books by so many authors on a variety of subjects, mostly entertainment, but I've done coffee table books on film art and how-to books, and then a lot of books about cult television or you know, Maverick, Fugitive Recaptured, in addition to Dark Shadows.
Yes.
So I really loved delving into these subjects, and I'm continuing to do it. I simply love book publishing.
Wonderful. You are multi-talented, and I want people to check you out. Catherine Lee Scott, that's L-E-I-G-H. I had to learn, like, because there's two different ways to pronounce it. How many people pronounce it wrong for you?
Oh, no, not that many.
Good, good.
A-T-H-R-Y-N-L-E-I-G-H-S-C-O-T-T. And I just look for me online. It's my full name, CatherineLeeScott.com.
Wonderful.
And just check it out.
Yes, and you are appearing at the Dark Shadows Remembrance Weekend, July 5th and 6th, Burbank, California. And you can celebrate so many of these wonderful past and present actors of Dark Shadows, and tickets can be purchased through Eventbrite, and they can also reach you and find out what great work you're doing at your website, which you just shouted out to everyone. But you're a pleasure, and you are getting lovelier with age. You really are. You are beautiful.
Thank you, Doreen.
Well, thank you. And anytime when you have the new documentary coming back out, anything you want to discuss, please, you have an open mic here.
That because there are a couple of really wonderful people that are going to be a part of it. And it's I'm very excited about the new material that we're adding to the documentary.
I would love to do a round table with you and some of the people. Maybe we can do a Playboy The Real Story round table. That would be a wonderful show to do.
Very good.
All right. Thank you so much. Yes. And please have a wonderful day. And thank you for spending a little time on the scene with Doreen with me.
Thank you.
Have a good one. Thank you to my incredible guests today, the wonderful Howard Jones and, of course, Catherine Lee Scott. And thank you again for tuning in to The Scene with Doreen. I'm here each week across the country bringing you the best interviews from the entertainment world and beyond. Get connected with me on social media and on our official website, thescenewithdoreen.com. And make sure to tune in next week so you can find out what's going on. Bye.